punishment? She said. We don't do punishments, Charles replied. We do projects. This is your project. Sort, organize, catalog.
Stevie looked down the row. It looked like it contained bins of doorknobs, stacks of old magazines, bags of junk.
You can start now, he said, if you feel up to it.
Sure, she said.
Then I'll leave you to it. Just let security know when you're done. You may need to do this over a few days, so I'll arrange it that someone can take you up here.
He left her alone with all of the treasures. As punishments went, this was about as good as it got. She wandered the aisles, taking in the view passively. She allowed the patterns to sink into her mind. Clothes here, furniture there, globes, books, dishes. It was her and the Ellingham items, and they became familiar with this repetition. She spent some time standing in front of a massive cabinet with horizontally glass-fronted shelves before working up the courage to open it up and pull out a delicate soup bowl. White, with a pattern of pink flowers and tender green vines, edged in gold. At the bottom of the dish, the letters AIE were also painted in gold. There was a stack of books near the china. She returned to the first row he had taken her to and looked at the long green ledgers. Some contained orders of groceries and household supplies. These people went through a lot of food on the weekends. Endless lemons and oranges and eggs and mint for drinks. Massive orders of cigarettes to be put in cigarette dispensers. Notes of dozens of smashed champagne glasses and orders of fresh ones. Floor wax for the scuffs in the ballroom. One book just contained household menus. Stevie paged through it until she found April 13th, 1936. It was written in a neat, precise hand. Main table. Crème de celery soup. Filet of sole with sauce amandine. Roast lamb. Minted peas. Asparagus hollandaise. Potatoes lyonnaise. Cold lemon soufflé. April 14 was not as elaborate. No main table service. Tray taken to office. Sandwiches of cold chicken and ham salad. Sliced celery and stuffed olives. Lemon cake. Coffee. Guest, Miss Flora Robinson, tray service. Clear soup, tea with milk, tomato juice. Sandwiches of cold chicken salad, sliced celery, junket. Guest, Mr. Leonard Nair, tray service. Scrambled eggs, coffee. Insignificant though this may have seemed, it gave a sense of the day and the change in the household. Everything had been going along as normal on the 13th. On the 14th, it was a different place. The tray of cold sandwiches, thrown together because they had to eat to keep going. The weird addition of just some sliced celery that had probably been around from the day before, and some olives. Eat anything, anything, whatever is there. Some cake that was probably already made. The coffee to keep them going. Flora Robinson and Leo Holmes Nair seemed to have eaten in their rooms. Simple foods. Foods you ate when you were sick or hungover. Scrambled eggs, broth, and more coffee and tea. Just stay awake. The whole house crackling with nervous energy, waiting for the phone to ring. And still, the butler recorded it, this desperate meal. Because that was how things were done. The kitchen staff had probably been questioned as well, so they didn't have as much time to prepare food. She worked her way along the row, pulling out boxes of old office supplies. Three telephones, rolled maps, wax tubes, telephone directories. One large velvet-lined box held a number of items that seemed unique. A crystal ink pot, a fine pen, pushpins, paper clips, a stack of business cards, an invitation to a dinner party on October 31, 1938. That was a meaningful date. These were the things that must have been on his desk when he died. She shuffled through them, the notepad with some circles and numbers drawn on it, with drips of ink on the page, a bit of ripped newspaper with information about the stock exchange, a Western Union telegraph slip with the words 10-30-38. Where do you look for someone who's never really there? Always on a staircase, but never on a stair. His last riddle, with no solution given. On the 30th of October, 1938, Albert Ellingham told his secretary that he was going for a sail. He seemed strangely bright that day. He took George Marsh, his loyal friend, with him. They sailed out of Burlington Yacht Club. Later that evening, residents of South Hero heard a boom and saw a flash on the water. Ellingham's boat had exploded. The wreckage revealed a bomb had been placed on board. The anarchists who had long dogged him, who had been blamed for the murder of his wife and the disappearance of his child, seemed to have gotten him in the end. Last things were so strange. Most people had no control over or concept of what their last acts would be. She wondered for a moment if Hayes had realized what was happening to him, that he was going to die while filming a video at school. For a moment, she remembered the letter on the wall, her vision. It had seemed so real, but there was no way it could be. It made no sense. It had simply been a vivid dream caused by a racing mind. Stevie did not believe in psychics, in precognition. She didn't think she had seen Hayes' death coming. The word murder had appeared in her dream, but that was because murders happened here. There was nothing spooky about it. She dreamed of a murder. There was a murder. Albert Ellingham wrote a riddle, as he did many times, and then he died. She stared at the little telegram slip for a long time, examining the words, the ink, the old but well-preserved paper. This must have been Ellingham's last riddle, something he was working on the day he died. A little bit of nonsense, a return to his old way of being. And then fate interrupted. Had anyone noticed this before, this little bit of detritus from his desk? Or did no one care about his little games in the wake of his death when the great empire had to be managed? Who cares about a little riddle when one of the richest men in the world dies? Stevie carefully put the slip of paper back in the box, like she was setting a flower on his grave. Her eyes teared up a bit and her throat grew rough. She wiped her eyes with the back of her hand and went over to one of the windows and looked out over the expanse of the campus and the view beyond. Death had come to Ellingham again. Death loved this place. But if Stevie was going to cope with being here, cope with the job she wanted to do, she had to look death in the eye. She could not be afraid or cry whenever she saw a sad memento. She had to be tough. That's what the dead deserved. But, Stevie wondered, what was the solution to the riddle? What was always on a staircase but never on a stair? Federal Bureau of Investigation. Interview between Agent Samuel Arnold and George Marsh. April 17, 1936, 5:45 p.m. Location, Ellingham Property. S.A.
Thank you for taking the time to speak to me again.
GM.
Whatever you need me for.
S.A.
This has been a difficult few days.
GM.
I haven't slept in two nights. Doesn't matter. Iris and Alice are still out there. Can I have one of your cigarettes?
S.A.
Of course. Can I just go over your relationship to Albert Ellingham and the safety concerns in the past? You were with the New York Police Department when you met?
GM.
That's right. I was a detective. We'd been working an anarchist gang that was causing trouble. We found out that they were planning to bomb an important industrialist. We found out it was Albert Ellingham, and luckily I got there in time.
S.A.
You personally saved his life moments before the car exploded.
GM.
I did my job. After that, Mr. Ellingham was kind enough to recommend me for the FBI. I worked out of the New York office. You ever work out of New York?
S.A.
No, only Washington. Director Hoover sent me up here to work this case.
GM.
Mr. Ellingham asked me to come up to Vermont when he built this place. I do field work for the Bureau and I consult for him.
S.A.
But you don't live here in the house.
GM.
No, I live in Burlington. I come here whenever Mr. Ellingham needs me. I usually come up when important guests are here. I was here for the party that weekend, mostly because Maxine Melville, the film star, was here. He wants to sign her for his studio, so he had her come up for a visit. The weekend party was mostly to entertain her. I watch the place, watch for press, make sure the staff don't get too nosy. They're pretty good, but people get strange around famous people.
S.A.
What's your thought on the missing student?
G.M.
Wrong place, wrong time, most likely. I've looked through her school files. Good kid. Real smart. One of the brightest here. But she liked to find places to hide and read. I heard you found a book of hers in the observatory.
S.A.
That's right, we did.
G.M.
Damn. Poor kid.
S.A.
What was your assessment of the letter that came in on April 8th, the one that we've been calling the truly devious letter?
G.M.
Mackenzie handles all the correspondence. He shows me the ones he thinks are trouble.
S.A.
But he didn't show you this letter until after the kidnapping?
G.M.
It was a busy weekend. I think there wasn't time. By the time I saw that letter, the thing was underway. Mackenzie's always on top of things. It's just too bad he didn't tell me. Not that it would have changed anything.
S.A.
What do you mean?
G.M.
I mean that it's hard to get Albert Ellingham to change his plans. Like this place, for example. You see exactly what I see. The advantage and disadvantage of this place is its location. On one hand, it's hard to get to, so it's not going to be the target of spontaneous crime. You have to really make an effort to come here, and then you have to make a bigger effort to get away. But as we've found out, the disadvantage is that there are many places to ambush and many ways to escape.
S.A.
Surely, as someone who foiled a bomb plot on Albert Ellingham once before, this occurred to you?
G.M.
It worried me to death. I talked about it with Albert. I suggested getting more men up here to guard the place. He said no.
S.A.
Why?
G.M.
His words. It's not conducive to playful learning. His words.
S.A.
So he went without the necessary security?
G.M.
Listen, there's something you need to understand about Albert Ellingham. He's a great man. No one I admire more aside from J. Edgar Hoover himself. But he thinks he's invincible. He thinks he can do anything. Because in his experience, he can. He made all of his own money, everything he has, his newspapers and movie studio and the rest, he built from nothing. The guy was a newsie as a kid, lived on the street, didn't have two pennies to rub together. Man's a genius. But he thinks nothing can touch him. I don't think he keeps me around because he thinks I actually help. I think he sees me like a lucky rabbit's foot. I saved him from that bomb, but he saw it as luck, and he took me along. I'm grateful. But he believes his will is enough. Something like this was always bound to happen. I knew it. You can see it. It was always bound to happen.
Interview terminated, 6:10 p.m. 22. The Ellingham coach system was back in effect the next day on a special schedule to allow students and parents to meet. There were two stops, the rest stop and Burlington. Stevie had arranged to meet her parents at the rest stop. She waited for the coach with a number of other people. To settle herself, she had her earbuds in and her podcasts on. And she was settled, until David sidled up next to her. He was not dressed in his normal David gear of wrecked jeans and some old t-shirt. He had on a crisp blue fitted dress shirt, one that tapered elegantly down to a pair of well-cut black pants. He even wore black dress shoes. Everything about his appearance was crisp and tailored, and showed off his slender, muscular frame. All of this was capped off by a slim-fitting black coat. Stevie had limited experience with guys in dress clothes. Suited detectives on TV didn't count. David was showing his plumage, and it stirred feelings in Stevie that were physically agitating. "I hope you get the job," Stevie said, looking away from him. I think they really need you up in corporate accounting.
Is that a deduction?
He said.
Get it? Accounting joke and detective joke.
Where are you meeting your parents?
I'm not,
he said, pushing his hands deep in the pockets of his long black coat.
They are safely far away. I'm just getting the hell out of Dodge.
So why the...
I like to look nice when I go to see His Majesty the Burger King. And where will you be going?
To eat, and hopefully coming back to school if my parents don't think this place is full of deranged liberals that let people get murdered, which is sort of what they are currently thinking. The coach pulled up and Stevie and David got in. Stevie sat by the window, and David plopped down next to her.
So, he said, you want to talk?
About what?
About the other night.
Most of the other people in the coach, not that there were many, were talking or listening to something already. But this was still public. Stevie felt herself break into a cold sweat. Is there a reason you're doing this? She asked.
I just want to know. I like learning. That's why I'm an Ellingham student. Learning is fun. Learning is a game.
How serious are they about the policy regarding using violent language with another student? She asked. Her palms were starting to sweat, and her forehead, and her feet? What the hell was that? Why was the human body such a jerk? Why did it flood you with hormones and sexy feelings and also flop sweat?
Deadly,
he said sternly.
Look, she said, I have enough to worry about. My parents are probably going to pull me out of school tonight, so...
Life finds a way, he said. Didn't you learn anything from Jurassic Park?
He rested his head back and put a large set of over-ear headphones on and left Stevie to think that one over. The coach made its way back on the path past the farmyards and the maple candy stores and the glass blowers and the Ben and Jerry's signs, back to I-89 and all the way to the rest stop where Stevie's parents waited now, next to their maroon minivan, bundled tight. David stood to let her go by, and then he continued right off the coach. She thought he was just taking extreme steps to make room for her, but he remained off the coach and followed her right to her parents.
I'm David,
he said, extending his hand.
David Eastman.
Why was David introducing himself to her parents? Nice to meet you, David, her mother said. Are you meeting your family here?
No. Stevie said I could maybe ride into Burlington with you, if that's no trouble. If it is, I can just catch the coach when it comes by again.
Stevie saw the light come on in her parents' eyes. They looked from David to Stevie and back to David again, and they liked what they saw. Stevie felt the ground moving away from her feet.
Of course not, her mom said. You'll come with us.
We're going to get something to eat, her father said. If you'd like to come.
Stevie couldn't move. Her body had gone rigid. David, don't. David, it's not a joke. David.
Sure,
he said with a smile.
If it's not a bother. Oh, it's no bother,
her dad said. She saw David take in the Edward King sticker on the back of the minivan. He gave her a sideways look, then went to the back door of her family's car and opened it.
After you. He said.
I will kill you, she said in a low voice.
I'm telling you, they are serious about that policy.
She walked around to the other side. All four of them were off together in the Bell family minivan down I-89 as the dark fell over the land. The ride into Burlington was quick. They rode through the university section, got stuck on the waterfront road along Lake Champlain, and turned back onto one of the many small and charming streets. The entire order of the world was now thrown. There should be no David here with her parents in this place. Though the volume was turned low, Stevie could hear the familiar mumble of her parents' favorite talk radio show, the one that always talked about how those people were trouble, the one that proselytized about Edward King. They switched it off, which was something. There were many fine restaurants in Burlington, and fine restaurants tend to be expensive. Stevie had looked up a place off Church Street, the main shopping and social area, that looked like it had good sandwiches and salads and didn't cost too much. There were free places to park as well. The restaurant was the kind of place where you ordered at the counter and paid and took a number back to any table you liked. Stevie's mom and David ordered first. Stevie's dad took longer to examine the menu, and Stevie considered impaling herself on the potato chip display rack.
"Vegetarian roast beef sandwich," her father said. "I wonder how that works."
"They use a substitute," Stevie said in a low voice.
"Then it's not roast beef, is it?"
Stevie's eyes fluttered closed for a moment.
"Don't make that face," he said. "I'm just making a joke. Can't I make a joke?"
"Don't make that face, Stevie. Don't be smart, Stevie. You think you know so much, Stevie, but wait until you get into the world. You'll see things don't work that way."
"We came up to see you. Can't we make this a good visit? We can always take you right back home."
"Don't react. Don't give in. Just get through this. Go back." The moment settled.
"I like him," her father said. "Very polite. Opened the door for you."
"He's a treasure," Stevie said. At the end of the line, down where you picked up your order, David appeared to be entertaining her mother to no end, and... oh, no. He was getting out his wallet. He was insisting, clearly insisting, that he pay. There was the credit card. Another joke. She was laughing away, charmed half to death. Stevie distinctly felt part of her soul die. She hoped it wasn't an important part. They took a table by the window. The cold air penetrated the glass, and Stevie invited the chill. It suited her mood. She examined her overstuffed chicken sandwich, found it was too heavily stuffed to ever pick up and eat, and so tipped it to the side and ate the component pieces with a plastic fork while her parents quizzed David. David, for his part, was all dark hair and eyes and waggling eyebrows on the other side of the table. He managed to get his massive sandwich in his mouth and conduct a conversation at the same time. His speaking voice was clearer, she noticed, like he was putting on a show. He was messing with her head.
"So what do your parents do?" Stevie's father asked. "My mom is a pilot," he said between bites.
Stevie looked up. David calmly ate a fry and then stacked the remainder into a Jenga pile.
"A pilot?" her father repeated. "That's very impressive. Must be hard to have a family when you do that kind of job. What does your father do?"
"Well," David said, breaking a fry in half and examining the fluffy insides,
"he runs a fertilizer plant."
Stevie looked up at him sharply. Was he making fun of her parents? A pilot and someone who ran a crap plant? Stevie felt a wall of rage building inside of her. She may not have agreed with her parents on things, but they were her parents, not for anyone else to taunt.
"Very impressive," her dad said.
Her face was burning. She put her cup on her cheek for a second to cool her skin. "So," her mother said, "we need to talk about what happened. This is a pretty serious conversation we need to have with Stevie, David."
"Sure," David said. "I had it with my parents, too."
"And what did they say?" He leaned back in his chair with that ease that only guys are supposed to possess and that Stevie intended to master.
"It's horrible,"
he said,
"but accidents happen."
"How did the school let this happen?" her mom said. "That stuff should have been under lock and key." "It was," Stevie said. He broke in.
"Couldn't have been that well locked up then,"
her dad said.
"Some people go to a lot of effort to get into locked places," David said with a long, steady look at Stevie. "He stole someone's pass."
"He was famous," her mother said. "The news is making him out to be a nice kid."
"That doesn't mean anything," David said. "The news can't tell you what people are really like." "That's the truth,"
Stevie's dad said. Stevie tensed. "Please don't start."
"Stevie and I don't see eye to eye on some things," her dad went on. "But the media..."
She felt her resolve slipping. Her eyes were going to roll back into her head, and she was going to exit via the window and escape. She could live in the mountains and eat rocks.
"Tells us what we want to hear, generally," David said.
Stevie felt her heart stop for a moment. Also, now her father was going to go for him, which would be something to see.
Interesting,
Stevie's father said, nodding.
You've got a smart one here, Stevie.
It was like she'd been punched in the gut. Stevie said stuff like that all the time and was told she was wrong. David said it once and he got a nod and a compliment. Oh, the magic of dudes. If only they bottled it.
We got a call, Stevie,
her dad said, picking a bit of tomato out of his sandwich.
Edward King called us. Well, his office, his people.
Edward King is our senator, her mom explained to David. He's a great man, but Stevie is not a fan. Stevie clasped her hands together into a knot and pressed them into her solar plexus.
We've been asked to become the volunteer coordinators for the entire state,
her dad said.
I know you won't like this, Stevie.
Turn to stone, Stevie. Become a mountain.
That's amazing,
David said, slapping on a huge smile.
Congratulations.
Her parents were both looking at her. This was the test of fire. She could explode. That was her instinct. That mountain she had become was really a volcano. But if she could swallow it, if she could handle this, she would appear to be changed in a way they liked, and if she could do that, then maybe the door was not shut. Maybe. Just maybe. It hurt. It genuinely hurt. The muscles of her face resisted. Her throat wanted to close. But she pushed. She forced herself into, if not a smile, then something that sort of resembled one. She pushed the air out of her lungs, up her throat, and out of her mouth. That's great, she said. Two words. That's great. The worst two words she had ever uttered. Her parents looked at her. They looked at David in his dress shirt. This whole strange little drama had an effect, and she knew at that moment that they would let her stay. So why did it feel like she'd just lost the game? 23. There were only two seats left on the return coach when they reached it, so it was David and Stevie together again. Stevie felt the tightness in her chest and realized that she was balling her fists so hard in her pockets that her nails were cutting into her palms.
They seemed to like me,
he said. What the hell was that about? Stevie said.
You're welcome,
he said. Stevie got out her phone and stuck in her earbuds. David pulled one out.
What? You get to stay. Why are you so mad?
Because, Stevie said, I don't get to stay because of me. I get to stay because of you. Because they think we're dating. Because they probably think I've landed some rich, preppy boyfriend. I get to stay because there's a guy.
I know,
he said, his brows angling in annoyance.
That's why I did this. You said they thought that was important. That's why I came along. If you want me to learn my valuable lesson, you have to spell it out.
Dating, she said coolly, is what my parents think girls do. They date. So I have now achieved all they expect from me. Also, the Edward King thing? Yeah, I had to sit there and swallow that whole.
Seems to have worked out,
David said.
Again, not seeing why you're mad. You're here, they're far away.
Because, again, it's not me. It's Edward King, the guy who represents literally everything I hate. The guy is racist, fascist scum, and now my parents run his goon army for the state, and I had to smile.
I just want you to know, you didn't smile.
Stevie was too enraged for a moment to speak. She breathed heavily until she found her voice again. Also, your mom isn't a pilot, you lying freak, she added.
How do you know? She might be.
And your dad runs a fertilizer farm? She asked.
That one is true,
David said. Near the beach in San Diego?
Never swim there,
David said, gravely shaking his head. I know one thing that is full of shit, she said, and it's you. He shrugged as if to say, fair enough. What the hell is wrong with you? She asked.
Lots of things,
he said. You're a liar, she said.
Maybe we both are a little sensitive about our parents. I just wanted to help you solve your problem. Problem solved. You want to be mad? Be mad. Here.
He picked the dangling earbud back up, and she reinserted it. But she didn't turn anything on. She looked out the window, and at his pale reflection in the glass, she found herself annoyingly transfixed by the line of his jaw. At first, it had looked so sharp to her, like his face was coming to a point. It wasn't that sharp after all. He must have been tense before, jutting it out. He was looking at his phone now, paying her no attention. Except he had made his hand into a little spider and was dancing it along his thigh. She watched it, as she was surely supposed to, and it crept closer to her leg, then backed off. Then it approached again, with one tentative spider leg finger hanging over hers, but not touching, not touching. Just the very tip touched. Was it even touching? Her entire body was static, anticipatory. The coach made the violent turn into the drive, jolting them and washing the spider away. Stevie walked ahead of David when they got out on the drive. When she was halfway to Minerva, she slowed, expecting his footsteps behind hers. He was nowhere in sight. She entered the common room, a ball of frustration. "How was it?" Janelle said when Stevie passed her room. Janelle was in the middle of a pile of math books and wires and an open computer playing a TV show. "Good," Stevie said, taking as casual a stance as she could. "Good, I think it's okay. I'm staying for now." Janelle made an excited squeaking noise. "Come sit," she said. "I'm just going to..." Stevie tilted her head toward her room. "I just need a few minutes." Inside her room, she paced around with her coat on. She looked at herself in the mirror. Her cheeks were bright red from the cold. Her short hair was pressed flat against her head from the pressure of her knit hat. It was time to ask herself something she had never seriously considered. Was she attractive? What was attractive? What did other people like? She knew what she liked. The short hair. She liked the way she looked when she narrowed her eyes because it was sharp and penetrating without being too squinty. She liked the fullness of her mouth because she was not afraid to speak up. She felt solid in the fullness of her hips. Was this what pretty was? Who knew? This was what a Stevie was, anyway. She grabbed the top edge of the bureau and stretched her arms out, looking down at the floor. Stevie knew about panic. What she didn't understand as much was this new hormonal cocktail her body had on the menu and what it meant for her plans. She wanted to go upstairs. She wanted... David. She wanted him. David, who had just made her madder than anyone else aside from her family. David, who she had to see every damn day. Someone who came in from a run smelling rank and appeared again in the common room all spicy and clean and... Why him? Out of anyone, why did the hormone gods pick him? She heard him come in. Heard him come into the hall. Was he going to stop? No, there was the loud creak of the steps. She had to go and talk to him, maybe. She wasn't sure what about. She slipped out of her coat, paced the length of her room, and found herself leaving and heading upstairs. Once at his door, she stood there uncertainly. She didn't come up to this floor that often. The guys had to come down, but this place was optional. It was darker up here. The wind made more noise. She raised her hand to knock and held it in place for a full minute before bringing it timidly down on the wood. When David opened the door, he did not look cocky. The heat collected up here, so it was extremely warm. The only light on inside was a small bedside lamp.
"You want something?"
he said.
"I want..."
What did she want?
"To understand."
"What? Life? The universe?"
"I want to know what your deal is," she said.
"My deal? What's a deal?"
"There's something you're not saying,"
she said. There's something.
There's something you're not saying either, he replied. Why won't you mention that we made out?
What am I supposed to say about it? She said, her face flushing.
Wow. You've got real blushing issues. You gotta work on that.
She tipped her head up angrily. What is it we are supposed to talk about? She said. Technique?
We could. I thought yours was good. You really like to explore with that tongue. Every part of you is a detective, I guess.
Okay, she said, turning to the door. Goodbye.
I annoy people, he said. Believe me, I'm aware. It's an effective way to communicate if you don't have any other options. If you can't get in through the door, throw a rock through the window. And I think maybe you're the same way.
This grounded her for a moment. It made sense, and she was always willing to grant when someone else made sense. He left the door open and moved away from it. She went toward it hesitantly, pushed it open a bit more, and stepped inside. He was sitting on his bed.
She comes in, he said.
Stevie tapped the doorframe nervously.
I think maybe I'm embarrassing you by talking about what we did the other night, he said. I actually don't want to embarrass you. That's not my goal. Maybe I'm more comfortable talking about that stuff. I guess there are some things I just don't give a shit about for the right reasons. I can tell you I liked what we did.
Her wrists were throbbing. Her pulse was going to make her hands balloon up, maybe explode from the pressure.
The fact is, he said, I liked you from the first moment I saw you. When you looked like you wanted to punch me in the face for just being alive. That probably says something dark about me. And I think you like me because I annoy you. Both of us have real problems, but maybe we should make our weird personalities work for us.
Stevie had often wondered how these conversations worked when people talked about feelings and touching and all of the stuff she thought was meant to be kept carefully bottled inside her own personal apothecary. Now someone wanted in, to take the lids off the vials, to peer at the contents. Stevie was unaware that people were even allowed to talk about emotions this frankly. This was not how things happened at home. She shut the door. Her hand shook as she did it, but that didn't matter. She took the few nervous steps to the bed and sat gingerly on the edge. Sitting on his bed, this was new dangerous territory. He didn't move.
So?
She said. What do we do?
What do you want to do?
Her eyes were going in and out of focus. She moved over toward him and reached around, putting her hand on the back of his head and pulling him closer. She wondered if he would strain against her hand, if this was all wrong. But his head moved forward. She pressed her lips to his. This time, the kissing was slow as they delicately balanced on the very knife edge of the bed. Their lips met and they would be together for a minute, then they would both stop and stay where they were for another few seconds, faces together, before doing it again. There was no pressure, no anxiety. It was like they were talking easily through the kisses. Her hand slid down his chest and she felt his heart beating hard. He was stroking her hair, running his fingers up the short strands. He leaned back against the bed and Stevie rested on top of him gently. And then, a knock.
David?
Pix called. Everything stopped dead. Reality came down with an audible thump. This could not happen again.
Closet,
David whispered. Stevie found her legs were wobbly when she went to stand. She stumbled over to the closet and climbed in with a pile of shoes and bags and ski equipment, all jumbled and smelling, not overpoweringly, but still, of use, pants and shirts crowding her head. She shut the door, closing herself in. David greeted Pix.
You need to go over to the Great House, she heard Pix say. Nothing's wrong. Charles just needs to talk to you about...
It's fine, he said. Sure, I'll come now. My coat's downstairs.
Quiet. They seemed to have gone. Stevie crouched in the closet, her heart thumping, rumpled and a bit overheated, her breath coming fast. She slowed it down, turned on her phone for light, and shone it around the closet space. She looked at his shoes, picking them up,
giving them the once-over. All had relatively unworn soles. Stevie had sneakers that had worn straight through the bottoms, and most of her shoes had scuffing to the toes, to the sides, little imperfections she either tried to hide or just accepted. These were new shoes, replaced regularly, and all name brands. There were dress shoes in here, made of soft leather, with the name inside, Ellis of London. Tennis gear, skis. Everything confirmed the diagnosis of well-off, and not the son of a pilot and the manager of a fertilizer plant, probably. When she heard nothing outside the door, she crawled out of the closet and went to the door. No noise. She was just in David's room. Alone. There is a principle often discussed in murder mysteries. Agatha Christie even wrote a book with the title, Murder is Easy. The idea is that the first time is the hardest, but once you transgress that barrier, once you take a life and get away with it, it becomes progressively easier each time. Stevie had yet to see anything in her reading that showed that this was necessarily true in real life, though it certainly seemed true that people may commit additional murders in a state of panic. Still, it logically held up. Murder is easy. And going through rooms is easy, especially if the owner of said room is someone who let you in and left you alone there. And she had so many questions. Who was David? The David with no social media. The guy who kept telling weird lies about his family. The desire to know was like hunger, really. It rumbled. It demanded information. Maybe she could just have a little look around? Just eyeball the place. There would be time. To walk over to the great house, meet with Charles, come back. That was a minimum of 20 minutes, even if Charles said very little. And it was probably best she wait in here a minute or two anyway, just to make sure Pix was gone. Just a little look around. He had a video game system, lots of computer gear, good speakers. Stevie had seen the brand advertised. Good headphones, good everything. His books were haphazardly piled. Subjects, philosophy, game theory. Lots of literature. Books on how to write. Interesting. Graphic novels. There was an e-reader on the stand next to the bed. She flipped through the library contents. More graphic novels. Lots of sci-fi. David liked a space opera, clearly. Books about history. David was a reader. An avid one. She put the e-reader back on the page it had been on when she picked it up and replaced it. She had a look at his bedside light, an Italian brand, another quality piece. Everything in his room was just a little bit better, from the weight and smoothness of his sheets. She sat down on the bed and gave them a feel, they smelled of him, to the heavy down comforter. She allowed herself to rest back on the bed for a moment. What else was in plain view? Police could look at things in plain view when they came inside with no warrant. The room was clean. Not tidy, but generally clean. An effort had been made to keep things in the right place. There was one old Led Zeppelin poster. But Stevie got the impression that it had just been put up as a kind of non-decorating. Get the first object you see, stick it up. The vast majority of the room was a blank canvas, without photos or decorations. She leaned back and her hand struck something hard. She reached into the sheets and pulled out his laptop. His laptop. Just sitting there. She looked it over for a moment. No stickers, no markings. She put her hands on the edge of the computer. To open or... The thing about looking just a little bit means it's really easy to look a little bit more. Once you've touched it, well, you've touched it. And if you have the computer in your lap and you open it and a screen comes up, there you are. Maybe this was what Pandora felt like when she got her famous box. Open it and the light pours out.
What the hell are you doing?
Everything stopped for a moment. How he had come upstairs without her hearing him was unknown. She must have been too into what she was doing. Of course, what she was doing was going through his computer. Answering his question would have been self-incriminating, so Stevie sat there, still and silent. Still things can sometimes appear invisible.
What?
David said again.
Are you doing?
I was just...
He came over and put his hands out for the computer. She passed it over.
I didn't even look.
It seems like you did,
he said.
Well, yeah, it did. He was right. Stevie felt her defenses snap back into place.
What's the big secret?
She snapped back.
You've met my family. You just got in the car and came along. You've had a look at me.
And you wanted a look,
he said.
Did it ever occur to you there's a reason I don't want to talk about my family?
We all have reasons, she said. You're not special in having a weird time with your parents.
My parents are dead,
he said.
Does that count as special?
One time, when she was little, Stevie was outside playing on a cold day. She caught some speed on a patch of ice and went full speed into a wall. As her abdomen made contact, she remembered the feeling of all the air being violently forced out of her body, scraping her throat as it exited. It sort of felt like that now. The angles had come back into David's features, and something else hurt.
Just get out,
he said.
Get out,
he said quietly. Federal Bureau of Investigation interview between Agents Samuel Arnold and Robert McKenzie, April 17, 1936, 7:10 p.m. Location, Ellingham Property. S.A.
Just a few more questions, Mr. McKenzie. We have to go through these things several times.
R.M.
I understand.
S.A.
When did you start working for Albert Ellingham?
R.M.
When I left Princeton 8 years ago.
S.A.
And you are his personal assistant in business matters?
R.M.
Correct. I am his personal business secretary.
S.A.
So you see quite a number of Mr. Ellingham's transactions.
R.M.
I see nearly all of them, if not all.
S.A.
Do you find it odd running the business from up here in this mountain location?
R.M.
I don't think any of us expected to be here this long.
S.A.
What do you mean?
R.M.
The school was just another project. Mr. Ellingham has a lot of projects. It seemed like he was planning for this to be a retreat, maybe to be used a few weeks in the summer. But he's been here since September. We all seemed to be waiting for him to say, all right, back to New York. But it never happened. We were here all winter. Do you have any idea what winters are like up here?
S.A.
Cold, I'd imagine.
R.M.
Half the time you can't leave the house for all the snow. The locals don't seem to mind. But everyone else had wild cabin fever. Mrs. Ellingham.
Pause. S.A.
What about her?
R.M.
Mrs. Ellingham is lively. She likes society and athletics. She did some skiing, but that wasn't enough. You could see it wearing on her.
S.A.
Did this cause friction between Mr. and Mrs. Ellingham?
Silence. S.A.
I know you feel a sense of loyalty, but there are things we have to know.
R.M.
I realize that. Yes, maybe a bit. They are very different people. A loving couple, of course, but very different people. I think being up here has been hard on her at times. She has Miss Robinson to keep her company. That seems to help.
S.A.
They're close.
R.M.
Like sisters.
S.A.
And what is Mr. Nair like?
R.M.
Mr. Nair is a brilliant artist and an inebriate.
S.A.
A frequent drinker?
R.M.
Often and in high quantities. I once watched him drink an entire case of champagne by himself. I was surprised he didn't die.
S.A.
Is he aggressive in that condition?
R.M.
On the contrary, he usually just paints or talks, and eventually we find him somewhere on the grounds asleep. The students once pulled him out of the fountain. If you're asking if he's capable of arranging a kidnapping, I don't think Leonard Holmes Nair is capable of arranging breakfast. This was organized.
S.A.
You're an organized man.
R.M.
Which is why I know organization when I see it. I'm professionally dull, Agent Arnold. It's why I was hired. I'm a foil to Mr. Ellingham's exuberance.
S.A.
It sounds like you're sensible. On the night of the 13th, you advocated calling the police.
R.M.
And I regret I didn't do it, even though I was told not to.
S.A.
You obeyed orders.
R.M.
I obeyed orders.
S.A.
Can you tell me about the letter that was received on April 8th? The truly devious letter? What did you make of it?
R.M.
We get, on average, 2 or 3 threats a day in with the regular correspondence. The vast majority of it is nonsense, and a lot of it from the same people. At first, this one struck me as a bit of a joke.
S.A.
Why a joke?
R.M.
The cutout letters. The poem. But then I noticed a few things. I noticed it was postmarked from Burlington, and then I noticed the address. You see, Mr. Ellingham has business correspondents from all around the country. As I'm sure you can imagine, mail delivery here is difficult. So we have all business correspondence directed to an office in Burlington, and we have it delivered by car every day, weather providing. If the weather is too bad, we have a secretary there who can read it to me over the telephone. What was unusual was that the letter didn't come to any of the business addresses. That's where most of the abusive mail goes to. It was addressed here, to this house. This one seemed much more personal.
S.A.
But you didn't show it to George Marsh.
R.M.
I was going to, but there was a great deal going on over the weekend. I was going to show him the next time he came by.
S.A.
So there was a party over the weekend.
R.M.
For Maxine Melville, yes.
S.A.
Did you attend?
R.M.
Only in the sense that I was in the house. I was very busy finalizing the paperwork on an important deal Mr. Ellingham has been working on. He's purchasing a newspaper in Philadelphia.
S.A.
Was there anything out of the ordinary about the weekend or Monday morning?
R.M.
Absolutely nothing. We went to Burlington on Monday morning to do some business and send some cables. We came back in the evening.
S.A.
Let's talk about this house and the school. Did you feel this location was insecure?
R.M.
Absolutely, considering the threats and the attempted bombing.
S.A.
Did you speak to your employer about this?
R.M.
I tried.
S.A.
You seem like a smart man, Mr. McKenzie. Your instincts were always to reach out to law enforcement. You have your eyes open. Where do you feel Iris and Alice Ellingham and Dolores Epstein might be?
R.M.
Nowhere good. To be honest with you, I think.
S.A.
Yes?
R.M.
I hate to say the words, Agent Arnold. I think that letter was from the kidnappers, and truly devious meant every word on that page. I think they're dead. God help me. I think they're all dead.
Interview terminated, 7:32 p.m. 24. Once upon a time, a young girl named Dottie from New York City came to Ellingham Academy and ended up dead from a knock on the head. Once upon another time, an actor from Florida came to Ellingham Academy and found out dry ice was not so nice. Third time's the charm. A girl from Pittsburgh came to Ellingham Academy and she wanted to see a dead body. She got her wish. That same girl snatched victory from the jaws of defeat and got to stay at Ellingham Academy. But then, worried that defeat might be hungry, promptly fed the victory right back to its gaping jaws. That girl had a taste of something she didn't know that she wanted or needed, and she had messed it all up. And life went on. Ellingham mourned and was counseled. There was an informal memorial in the cupola on the green, where people left candles and pictures and a small zombie doll. There were letters and phone calls from Charles and the other members of the board. Security tightened. Everyone's passes were checked and upgraded. Curfew became a real thing. And rooms were checked and grounds patrolled. It wasn't that anyone forgot about Hayes's death. The subject was constantly talked about. It was just something that had happened. It was part of reality. Though the investigation was not yet formally closed, information was made available to reassure everyone. Hayes seemed to have died in an accident of his own making. Hayes, a person known to make videos in dark corners, took something that didn't belong to him. His fingerprints were on Janelle's ID, and the golf cart used to move the dry ice, and a hand truck. This was, it was pretty clear to everyone, a case of Hayes really messing up. And he had stolen property as well. He had gone to great lengths to break rules, so his parents could hardly sue. The common wisdom was that Hayes had gone into the tunnel to film something new for the end of it all, hence going back alone, hence the secret. He'd seen the dry ice, looked in the tunnel, and had an idea that put it all together. He just put it together very badly. It was back to piles of books and anatomy labs and essays. Something called the Silent Party was scheduled, a dance with no sound or something. It was going to be in the Great House. That would pass as entertainment. Back to school. Because that was what Ellingham was, a school. Stevie tried to do this, but found her concentration was broken. She couldn't finish her reading, couldn't write her essays. The weather turned resolutely gray. Mountains are not kind when the season turns. The leaves on the trees started to turn gold and red at the tips, and a few overachievers made the trip to the ground. David did not talk to her. He was over Stevie's head, literally. She heard his steps, but that was about all she heard from him. He made himself scarce from the common room and the kitchen, and if he and Stevie crossed paths, he looked away. She would open books, stare at a page, and realize she hadn't taken anything in. Then she would read it again, the words slipping in the front door and out the back. There were essays to write that never got past the note stage. There was some leeway in all of this because of recent events, but the leeway was not going to go on forever. None of this escaped the attention of Janelle, who finally hooked Stevie by the arm and pulled her into her room and sat her on the bed. "Are you going to tell me what the hell happened with the two of you?" Janelle said. "What?" "You and David," Janelle said. Stevie blinked. "Do you think we don't know?" Janelle said. "Everyone knows. There is nothing in the world as obvious as the two of you. So what happened?" "We made out," Stevie said. "Yeah, I got that. And then what?" Shame is a terrible thing. Janelle would never go through Vi's room. Sure, Vi wasn't a lying weirdo, but even if she was, Janelle wouldn't do that. Janelle had standards. Janelle was loyal. Whereas Stevie was a cretinous person who had no principles. Janelle waited for a reply, and when she realized none was forthcoming, Stevie saw a light go out in her eyes. This left Nate and Ellie. Ellie's reaction to Hayes' death was to go maximum Ellie. Minerva was woken in the morning by the terrifying cries of Ruta. When painted makeup appeared on the Minerva gargoyles and some of the statues, it was fairly obvious who the culprit was. There was more drinking and bathing and French poetry. Which left Nate, and Nate had retreated to the misty mountains in his mind. He was always reading now, turning away from every conversation, frequently eating alone. Stevie found him in the dining hall at one of the small high-top tables, his face buried in a copy of the Earthsea trilogy and his fork working on a plate of turkey meatballs and pasta. Stevie pulled up a chair and slid over her tray of lasagna and salad with maple dressing because she had given up fighting the maple syrup. "Hey," she said. Nate peered out of his book.
"Hey,"
he said. She waited for him to put the book down. It took him a moment to get the hint. He put a napkin carefully between the pages as a bookmark. Nate didn't press books face down and ruin their spines.
"Talk to me about writing," Stevie said.
"Why do you hate me?"
he replied. "Seriously, tell me about it."
"Tell you what,"
he said.
"You write. That's it."
"But how do you do it?" she said. "Do you just sit down and write? Do you have to plan first? Do you just write whatever comes into your head?"
"Is someone paying you to do this to me?"
"It's just, Remember that first day when we were talking about zombies and Hayes had no idea what the Monroeville Mall was?
Yeah.
That was weird, she said. He waited for her to explain what she was saying, but she had no explanation. Nate returned to his book and meatballs. It's like Truly Devious, she said after a moment. Nate looked up with tired eyes, but he still looked up.
What about it?
The person they arrested for the Ellingham murders, she said. Anton Voracek. He could never have written that letter. His English was too rough. Anyway, who announces they're going to commit a murder?
Pretty much every serial killer, Nate said.
Very few serial killers do that, Stevie corrected him. The Zodiac was one of the only...
In movies, he said. In books.
Here's another thing, Stevie said, warming to the topic. There's an old mystery riddle. A man is found hanging in an empty room, locked from the inside. There is no chair, nothing for him to stand on. How did it happen?
Stood on a block of ice, Nate said. Everyone knows that one.
Right, Stevie said. It's just like the one about someone being found stabbed to death in a locked room and there's no weapon. The weapon was an icicle. It's so well known that no one can use that device in mystery stories. It's like saying the butler did it, but worse, it can never be ice.
Yeah, well, this isn't a mystery story.
Don't you wonder what Hayes was